ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
For decades, a quantum computer has been just around the corner. So, where is it?
If you'd asked me very early on, I would have been very pessimistic.
The race to build a quantum computer...
Then I got more pessimistic.
Can anyone actually do it?
And more pessimistic.
One of the biggest tech stories on Earth. I'm Jacinta Bowler. Search for Science Friction, Dead and Alive, on ABC Listen, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, welcome to the show that gives you a front row seat to live events with big thinkers everywhere. I'm Natasha Mitchell with Big Ideas on ABC Radio National. The focus of the annual Make Good Festival in beautiful Bundanon, New South Wales, is on ideas for a better world. Of course, your idea of a better world might differ to mine, but after flying high and hitting a wall big time, Jack Toohey's thinking about why we feel so powerless to change the status quo on so many fronts right now started to crystallise into a book called Better Things Are Possible, How Rebellious Hope Will Change the World. And we sat down together with an audience on a brilliant blue sky day with the Shoalhaven River as our backdrop on Dharawal and Dirga country.
Like when you walk into Parliament House, yeah, when I first went there, I got in trouble for knocking on a MP's door because they said, you don't knock around here, you just walk in. And I was like, what? These lobbyists, they're getting paid obscene amounts of money and they're just always there. They're probably there when Parliament's not even sitting. They're probably keeping chairs warm for people. And then you see with like every resource minister, this side of the millennium, like, has gone into work in the resource industry afterwards, and they know that they have a career afterwards and a really cushy job if they just toe the line.
But Jack wants to give you ideas on how the line doesn't necessarily need to be towed, and nor do you need to doom scroll your way towards an unknown future. He's a creative director and filmmaker who's outspoken on social and climate justice issues. That's not where he started. But in 2023, as a millennial rightly pissed off at housing affordability and inequity in Australia, he put some data together, created a punchy video, popped it on social media, and over 20 million views later. So from soil health to the solar revolution, the manosphere to mining companies, mental health to housing, innovation, capitalism, his data-driven, firmly argued book covers it all. Let's go talk to him.
Thank you.
For this book, Jack, you went searching for hope punks. What's a hope punk?
The status quo is apathy and non-caringness in Australia. We often, like, you know, say no worries mate and she'll be right, and these kind of ideas where we just kind of think that everything is going to turn out all right. And after kind of the neoliberal period, we've all just been kind of told to think for ourselves and, yeah, just not really have this forward-thinking, hopeful vision for the future. And so if that apathy is kind of the status quo, then hope must be the punk thing to be, being hopeful and putting yourself out there and trying to pitch a better future. We are the punk, we're the counterculture. So I was like, I'm going to run with that.
Yeah, I love the idea of hope and punk combined, being a bit of a punk subscriber. I think that's a delicious combination. But for you, hope is not a passive thing.
No.
It's not just a wanting to be, it is actually a willing and an enacting.
Yeah. People often put optimism and hope in the same category, and I think that optimism often slips into like blind optimism, the no worries, she'll be right kind of thing. It's a very passive way of thinking that things are just going to turn out. And that's not really how things change. That's not how rights are won. It's not how a better future is built. We have to be active. And I think hope is this idea of believing that better things are possible and actually doing something about it. But I think that often in our like society, we don't even get to that first step of believing that better things are possible because we're just going on the hamster wheel, quite consumed by what's immediately in front of us, that we're not often given the opportunity to hope beyond that.
So you take us on a bit of a journey, the journey that you took to travel Australia and in search of fellow Hope punks, and you found many of them and they have wonderful stories to tell about really making big, beautiful changes in their communities. But before you went on that journey, you went on another journey and it was up the Hume Highway and it was a significant moment for you because there was a profound falling apart.
An unravelling over time. Yeah, during COVID, I think the way that I describe it in the book is that I'd started a creative business when I was quite young. I was about 22 and I'd been running that, you know, working kind of round the clock as a young business person to just say yes to everything, every economic opportunity that came our way. And that business had built to about five, six people on staff when COVID rolled around. And obviously with lockdowns and stuff, it made kind of, it was difficult to go to, there were no music festivals, for example, to shoot. And you know, there were no activations from brands to go and capture photography for. So all of a sudden we just ground to a halt. For me, as someone that had been going through life describing myself as a busy person when people said, how are you? When I stopped, I really didn't have a way of describing who I was if I wasn't busy and creating. And so that kind of coupled with a relationship breakdown, I just reached a point of what I felt like was no return on the side of this highway, where I just completely broke down and thought the best way forward was no way forward at all, I guess, no, just to end things there. And so thankfully that's not what happened, and I started the slow quite extreme path back to reclaiming my life and figuring out who I was, even when I wasn't busy, and realizing that I was a lot more than someone that's just a busy person.
But more than that, and you write about this beautifully in the book, you went through a process of therapy, dialectical behavior therapy. We all think that people probably need to do that from about five onwards. But the point that you make in the book is really powerful to me, that in going through this process of radical self-acceptance, you started to also head down a path of not accepting where the world has got to. Tell us about that relationship.
Yeah, so something that I learned about in that therapy, which I highly recommend. It's very expensive though, that's the barrier to entry, but and time intensive. But one of the topics that we learned about, one of the skills that we learned, was radical acceptance. So I think when you're struggling with, you know, depression and anxiety and these feelings, like feeling like things aren't fair and you wish things were different, you can just end up in this kind of spiral. And this idea of radical acceptance is just to radically accept things as they are and work to change what you can change, and not get so caught up in what you can't. And so I really didn't realize then that that would be so transformative in my activism. I wasn't really an activist. I wasn't an activist at all at that time. I cared about the world, but I wasn't really doing much about that care. And so as I rebuilt my sense of self, I also rebuilt my sense of responsibility as a human on planet Earth, that breathes air and needs a habitable climate and could see injustices around me. And realizing that I also had like a lot of privilege within society and more power than others to change things. So I really started to apply this idea of radical acceptance, not thinking that, well, like there are these huge interconnected crises. Sorry, I probably hadn't connected them at that point. These crises, there's the housing crisis, there's a cost of living crisis, there's a crisis in masculinity and mental health, there's just neoliberalism ruining everything, continuing to do so, and realizing like there are things that I can't change as an individual, but there are things that I can change in my life, and there are also ways I can influence other people to join with me to radically accept things as they are, but believe that better things are possible. I'm going to keep saying the title of the book, and it's not because I'm trying to sell you books. It just is the crux of it.
You make the point that we lived in a developed economy. But you ask, do we live in a developed society? Tell us about your sense of that.
We just live in an economy. The markers of, you know, GDP, gross domestic product, doesn't tell us anything about how everyone in this room is doing on a personal level and an interpersonal level. It just tells us how good you are at making shit. And I don't mean making good shit. I mean just making shit to sell and the surplus value of that. We don't have any serious markers. And when we do, it's things like the Closing the Gap report or something. And we do nothing about, we go backwards on the Closing the Gap report. We, as an economy, decide that, like, or ethically, how we treat Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in this country is pretty bad. We should probably do something about it. And we put these markers for success, education, reducing the suicide numbers, these kind of things. We don't succeed at fixing those problems. But then kind of like when it comes to an election cycle, those things are fall to the wayside and we talk about, well, we mining is, you know, such a great export and we, you know, we make so much money from it and all, but we don't really think about people in our society. We think about workers in an economy.
You take on neoliberalism in with all its tendrils in this book. That's a big, powerful norm to take on. And what you're asking of us is really a wholesale societal change. So let's lean into that vision a bit. So you've come up with this term. It's called the equanimy.
Yes. The equanimy. Equal economy. Get it, everyone? Good. Thank you. Thank you.
So describe your vision.
I mean, I guess we need to get there first. And I think that we're in this very interesting period of time where I'm sure everyone in this room and anyone listening understands at some level neoliberalism and where it came from. But it came from an oil crisis was the thing that shifted us into this period of privatization and this idea of the individual looking after for themselves rather than like the state. After the post-war consensus, which when we sent all these people to die and serve the nation, governments, like liberal governments, were like, oh, well, now that they're coming back, we probably like need to probably like build our nation. We should probably provide housing. We should probably make jobs. We should create some jobs and we could make really massive infrastructure projects happen and housing and liberal governments believed that the government had a role to play in lifting people up because the people had served the nation and it just seemed like that, again, like it's called the post-war consensus. And this didn't just happen in Australia, it happened right around the so-called Western world.
And public housing, social housing was not stigmatised.
No. And because it was like, it was just everyday people, like people that had served in this war that were building those houses and then living in those houses. And those buildings still exist all around cities and towns around the country. And we still benefit from those big projects that happened. But as the oil crisis came and there's this period of stagflation where economic growth was started to stagnate, but there was a high period of inflation as well, everyone was like, well, maybe this post-war consensus ain't it. Like maybe we need to have some other kind of economic theory here. And neoliberalism was just like there. It had been developed in the back rooms by capital owners and it was ready and it was there. There was this new version of how to structure an economy and a society and it was neoliberalism and bang, we had it there. So it's interesting now that we find ourselves in an exactly similar situation where we are, I would say, at the end of this neoliberal period of 40, 50 years, and there's now an oil crisis which is upending the global economy. And it's like, well, we need a new idea that could structure the economies. Unfortunately, I do think that we're probably leaning towards fascism at this point, but there is the economy, so we start spreading the word.
The economy. You make the point, capitalism loves a crisis.
Yes. Well, it creates the crises and it benefits and profits from those crises.
So you think of the oil crisis, you think of the current fuel crisis, you think of COVID as a crisis.
Yeah.
In fact, capitalism has thrived.
Yes.
In each of those instances.
Yeah, well, Woodside's doing very well right now, you know, due to these crises like and the, you know, military industrial complex.
Pharmaceutical industry did very well.
Exactly. And so that by design, like the economic system that we're in, like needs to continue to have crisis for it to continue to survive because that's how it profits, that's how it makes lots of money and that's how like a dwindling group of people, like size of the group of people continue to make more and more profit. So that's unsustainable because we live on a planet that is finite and its resources are finite and it's just like crazy that we're even having these debates around like non-renewable and renewable resources. Like, well, at some point these non-renewable, they're going to run out. Or like, I guess they are renewable, but they take billions of years for our fossils to turn into, to compact under like sediment and marshes and all these things before we become oil and we can be burnt in a billion years' time.
But also, just to reflect too on the way in which the current system fosters inequality, you observe that, and there's great data in this book. It's a really great compilation of data to really develop your arguments. But the 10% most wealthy people in Australia, they have 40% of the wealth or something.
Yeah.
The top 200 people have the wealth equivalent to 25% of our GDP.
Yeah.
That's a staggering figure, and we've come to accept that as the norm, haven't we?
Yeah, and there's a bunch of people within like society that think that they can be that those people too, and that's why they kind of there's a delusion that some people in society have, or all of us have, to a point that we can achieve those great heights of success too, and so that stops us all realizing like actually no, this is clearly insane. And again, it just continues. Like whatever stats are in my book are now probably outdated by quite a lot because it's accelerating this accumulation of wealth.
And the disparity of wealth.
Yes. Some of these billionaires, like it's like us buying our morning coffee and then buying the coffee shop is kind of like the scale of difference. And like you can't buy a coffee shop every day. That doesn't make your life better. Like that doesn't make anyone's lives better. But that's actually what they're doing, like in terms of like this march towards monopoly. So we can't keep going this way. So that gives me a lot of hope as well, because we actually don't have a choice. We've painted ourselves into a bit of a corner, paint on our feet.
Better things are possible. How rebellious hope will change the world is Jack Toohey's new book, and his social media videos on Instagram and TikTok have attracted millions of views for his ability to really distill complex data and issues in compelling ways. Jack is my guest today on Big Ideas, coming to you on ABC Radio National and ABC Listen from the Make Good Festival in Bundanon, New South Wales. I'm Natasha Mitchell. We're working our way towards the vision of the economy, but another case in point is the housing situation. And you make a very interesting observation that, in fact, the amount of money as a community that we pour into our housing loans, if we even get that far in terms of getting a house and getting a loan, and you compare that to how much Australia spends on R&D and make the observation that, in fact, it is preventing us from being innovative as a society. Just make that connection for us, because I think it's a really potent one.
Yeah, in the book I apologise for apologising for John Howard, and I must do that again here. I will apologise for apologising for John Howard, but this idea of the capital gains tax discount, obviously like we're having these conversations again now, the initial idea, it was a neoliberal idea, but it was to encourage investment in business. This idea was like, we've privatized everything and now our shareholders are going to have a great time, but we need to encourage that investment so that the shareholders that are already in there can make more money and so on. But what happened was that paired with negative gearing, it meant that housing was like a really attractive and a very low risk place to put your money rather than the share market, which could be volatile at times. Mm. And so it basically moved capital into the housing market and away from big businesses and new businesses. And I do make like a capitalistic argument in the book that was bad, because we should be investing in businesses because ultimately they can innovate. I also make the argument that it doesn't have to be like individuals investing to stimulate innovation and cures for things. Like we can do that collectively as taxpayers to invest in innovation. And I don't think in Australia we really value innovation at all. We value bricks and mortar because it's safe and there's no risk. There's no risk. We pay interest on our home loans. I mean, I don't, because I'm a millennial and I will never be able to afford a house, but we pay interest. What's the point of this interest? It's because the bank is supposedly taking on risk on us. They need their share. They're going to take a punt on you. Oh, you want to buy that house? Oh, I don't know if you're going to pay back this loan, even though the house doesn't really matter because the house is appreciating value no matter what. So they're never going to lose, but they'll add 50% on top in interest by the time you pay your 30, 40 year loan. So
at what cost?
At the cost of not investing in innovation, not investing in science, in the arts, in things that actually improve our lives. We don't build public housing. We continuously defund the CSIRO, which is responsible for so many things that they made Wi-Fi, which, to be honest, now in hindsight, maybe wasn't such a good invention. Well, they also made banknotes that we can go for swims with and that doesn't disintegrate in our pockets. So, and continuously just defunding, even like under our current government, that they say that they value science and education, but I don't really see heaps of evidence of that.
Just sacked a sack of climate scientists.
Yes, exactly.
And climate data
at a time where we need climate scientists more than ever, like an increasing, in the same way that like our share of wealth is diminishing, our need for scientists and educated people that are going to come up with solutions for the problems that this group of people are causing, they're happening at the same time. So, and it's because they're part of the same system that devalues this idea. Like, we uphold passive wealth accumulation as what we aspire to be as Australians. Like, I talk about Neighbours and Home and Away and Bluey in the book, and like they're centered around houses. Around, there's something nice about that, but it's centered around this idea of like home ownership in a way.
In a lovely little cul-de-sac in the suburbs.
Yeah, and like that's the Australian dream. Like, yeah, I do want to live next to Toadie Rebecca. Like, he seems like a good neighbour to have, but I can't afford that cul-de-sac because we've put all of our money in there. It's $11 trillion or something stuck in housing. A little bit of that could be curing disease.
And you make the same point about superannuation.
Yes.
Now, superannuation has benefited a lot of Australians. That policy has benefited a lot of Australians, as capital gains tax discounts have, as, you know, negative gearing has.
But it's benefited us in a way, but like, how has it benefited us? It hasn't really. It's benefited us in the way in retirement, in lieu of the pension, in lieu of good public services, health, aged care. We've privatised all of that stuff. We wouldn't need super if we just were given a good livable pension and had access to great services. So even though we like, again, we just kind of passively understand that superannuation, yeah, it's good, I'm saving for retirement, I'm happy to pay that. And it's like not me paying it, it's my employer paying that. But we don't ever, aren't really given the opportunity to stop and think about like whether that's actually good. Super, to be fair, does invest in business. Often it's not businesses that are here. Often it's fossil fuel companies. So unless we're moving our super into ethical super companies that are actually investing in renewable infrastructure and things like that, where like we are funding through our super the destruction of the planet. So
and it's a big set and forget for a lot of people.
Yeah. And also a lot of it is offshored, and a lot of it goes to fees, and it goes to like people that are making like lots of money out of working for these super funds.
Including, ironically, public sector superannuation funds.
Yeah, exactly. So we're just siphoning money out of from our collective tax pot and just giving it more and more into the private sector and then offshoring it. And it means that we're not investing in local, and this, to answer your question about the economy, we're not investing in our communities. In like, I talk about like anchor institutions, like the big institutions like hospitals, schools, things that exist within communities that we could be directly funding and working with multiple kind of communities to create these networks. And we are seeing that, like down on the South Coast, there's some great like community-led solar communities that just kind of are pretty much fully off-grid now, and they just trade their solar power within them. Like there are these examples within society, which I kind of like.
Yeah, let's paint a really a clear picture of what your thinking is around this idea of the economy. It's going to take off.
Well, yeah, maybe. I don't
but,
know.
But it's a very...
It's a workshopping name, you know. It's a V1.
We might workshop title. The name. But it's a really powerful idea, and every all the themes under it are really potent.
And I kind of also talk about why I felt the need to like come up with a new title because of the way that these economic theories have been tainted, but also the way that Adam Smith, like, you know, the, one of the first people that wrote about capitalism existed hundreds of years ago. Like, Karl Marx didn't exist at a time where, like, I think toilet paper didn't exist. So, like, why are we like, looking to these guys for like, inspiration for how we build our economies today in the 21st century where we have things like Wi-Fi thanks to the CSIRO? It's hard for me to explain, honestly, because it's one chapter in the book.
But it is very much about... You use the idea of that we've moved from a sort of mateship community to a me-ship community where the focus is on the self, on individual attainment, and we've lost sight of the fact that we live in a society and that we can redeploy all of our efforts, our resources, our money to think differently about ourselves in relation to other people.
Yeah, it's about pulling resource for the collective benefit of the collective rather than pulling resource for the capital growth of, of the few. And like that does sound maybe a little bit Marxist, but like it's not really, it's basic humanity. Like these ideas that I'm talking about, I feel sometimes like, I feel kind of like a fraud, or like I feel a bit silly talking about this idea of like looking after each other, putting the collective benefit of each other above ourselves, and that will naturally benefit us by caring, because these aren't new ideas that have been here for 65,000
years. Isn't it crazy that caring, yes.
Yeah, and I think that like living in harmony, or living in sync with the within the bounds of our natural world, and giving in reciprocity with our natural world and each other, that shouldn't be like a radical idea, and it's not a new idea. Mm. But like when we're in this period right now, it just feels so alien in a lot of ways. And so I feel kind of silly sitting here and being like, just care about each other and care about nature and everything's going to be fine. It's not that I do put more structure
in. You do. You're totally tangible in this book. It's totally tangible. So let's look at some examples. Housing. And you use Vienna as an example.
Yeah.
So one idea under your economy theory is that we return to public ownership of some key things, yeah, including housing, including some core infrastructure.
Yeah.
So with housing, what's the idea there?
Well, it's like interesting with housing, right, is that we've just accepted that that should just be a private market where it's like 2% and reducing of the housing stock in this country is public housing.
Wasn't always that way.
It wasn't always that way. In under a Liberal government, it was something like, I think it was as high as more than 20%. Of completions were publicly owned and operated buildings and housing. And so if we apply that to like education, or we apply that to healthcare, and we look at America and we go, oh gee, like it's pretty lucky that we don't have the healthcare system where like your healthcare is entirely tied to your employer. Mm. And if you break an arm and you don't have private health insurance,
You're bankrupted.
We don't have that here, and we're very grateful for that, and we talk about it, although this is diminishing, like the share of public access to hospital beds and stuff is diminishing. And also somehow, like I only learned about this when I turned 32 or whatever, and I like had to get private health insurance, otherwise I pay more in tax, or there's some weird thing that funnels me into the private. So like it is kind of in our healthcare system, our education system. Like if we only had 2% of our education system was public, the effect of that would be catastrophic. That is the same. The same effect is, like, imagine the impact that would have on society. We have done that for housing, and Vienna, we are living in that reality.
And Vienna did something different, and so, that was a concerted choice of theirs.
Yes, and so they have a mix of housing. So they have public housing in the way that we understand it, but they also like have public housing. Like it's like doctors and teachers and all sorts of people live in this public housing, and they pay a share of their income. So it's not just like, it's not just one size fits all or one price fits all. It is reflective of your capacity to pay back for these models. And so we just have this weird notion where like we need to own this these like houses ourselves, but it doesn't really benefit anyone but the banks. So that doesn't really make any sense. So I do think that I think it's a long road. I think that the first thing that governments should be doing is building community housing and operating them at cost. They don't have to operate at a loss.
And maybe start with essential workers, because many essential workers now, yeah, nurses, doctors, teachers, they can't live in the communities they work in, yeah, anymore in Australia.
And again, like the degradation that that does to our society is very hard to quantify. But if people are leaving the workforce from teaching and nursing because they can't afford to live near a hospital or a school, which is often the thing, just like, well, move to where you can afford, that doesn't really serve us, and that is going to have a profound effect on our ability to continue. The people that are serving, who are caring, they're already doing what I'm saying. We are forcing them out.
He's a creative director, strategist, filmmaker, activist, and a millennial with a massive reach and influence on social media. Jack Toohey is author of Better Things Are Possible: How Rebellious Hope Will Change the World. Natasha Mitchell here, joining you with Jack on the stage of the Make Good Festival at Bundanon in New South Wales, which was once home to artists Arthur and Yvonne Boyd. Now Bundanon is a centre for creativity and learning.
so you look at regenerative farming, meet incredible farmers doing incredible things. You also look at climate change. And an interesting point that Jack makes is that we diminish our potential in Australia. We have this cultural cringe. And you actually think that when it comes to climate change and action as a nation on the global stage, that our smallness is our superpower.
Mm.
What's your thinking there?
Yeah, I mean, like, we have so much solar. We have a nuclear reactor in the sky that creates energy for us every day, and it creates the energy for everything on this planet that lives to live. And so we can harness that, and we have more ability to harness that because we have way more sunshine than other countries and way more land that we can use to harness that power. We are already doing that. Like, we have this amazing uptake despite, like, government's best efforts to make us not do it. We've taken up rooftop solar in great numbers, and that is, when I was, you know, talking about this oil crisis and stuff, like, that's helping us right now. People just taking it upon themselves to do these things because it actually just has, like, a pretty good economic, it just makes sense to do. But we have an abundance of wind
energy.
We've
long been a leader in solar.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. And we used to hold the records for, like, most efficient solar panels. UNSW, like, got it, and then they lost it, and they got it again. But that was, like, I don't know how long ago, 15 years ago now. I don't think we've held the record because we don't fund these kinds of things. But we can export, that technology if we were investing in that, because we have an abundance of renewable resource that we should be learning to harness, and we can share that knowledge with the world. I don't even think we necessarily have to be this gross exporter of solar energy or wind energy or whatever, although there are projects building undersea cables to transport solar energy from the Northern Territory to Asia. And I think that we do have, like, a responsibility as a very, very wealthy nation that has benefited a lot from degrading the global climate to come up with new solutions and help the global south to get the energy they require to be emerging economies, societies, to lift people out of poverty. And if you want to make a capitalist argument, we could also make lots of money doing that. So we're just so tied to fossil fuels, and our economy is so tied to fossil fuels. But we already have this kind of infrastructure mentally, mentally as an economy, around being, we supply energy, an energy supplying nation. We can shift to be doing that in a way that is, again, coming back, like, living in harmony with the bounds of the natural world.
The mining boom has protected us from a global financial crisis. It's obviously been a very powerful economic driver in this country. It's part of our success story. Yep. But you also look at the way in which power works in this nation, and the way big business works in this nation, the relationship between corporations and the government, the idea of fossil fuel capture, the way lobbyists work inside Parliament House, and also how the media works, how particular narratives dominate over others. And so these are all really important things to talk about, aren't they? Because they are what keep the status quo alive.
Yeah. Like, when you walk into Parliament House, you go to, like, the cafes back behind, like, you know, where the primary schools and visitors can go, and you can look, and you have to exit out of the gift shop and stuff like that, which I always think is crazy. Someone signs you in, you go back to the next bit.
You buy your Parliament House tea towel in the shop,
and then
what do you see?
You go back and you go through the halls of power, and you're like, who the fuck are all these people? What the? There's so many people here, and you go back there, and you just, like, there's all these people, and you realise that they've got these orange passes and they're lobbyists, and I can't remember the exact number, it's 3-1 or something. They outnumber politicians and staffers. I can't remember the exact number, but it's
hanging out, having meetings.
Just having meetings.
Walking the corridors.
When I first went there, I got in trouble for knocking on a MP's door, because they said, you don't knock around here, you just walk in. And I was like, what? Like, I'm here to talk, because I was talking about the housing crisis, trying to talk to as many MPs as possible. No government MP. Oh, no, I did speak to one government MP, which was Josh Burns, the most marginal Labor member at the time. They were like, he was the sacrificial lamb to me. But a lot of the independents and Greens were happy to talk to me. But I got in trouble for knocking, because that's just, like, kind of the culture of back there. You're wheeling and dealing, you have these conversations, but these lobbyists, they're getting paid obscene amounts of money, and they're just there. They're just always there. They're probably there when it's the Parliament's not even sitting. They're probably keeping chairs warm for people they come back. And then you see with like every resource minister, this side of the millennium, like, has gone into work in the resource industry afterwards. And you just like know that there's just this kind of, they know that they have a career afterwards and that really cushy job if they just toe the line. And
so they step out of their portfolio into the industry that their portfolio has been dealing with.
Yeah, exactly.
And likewise for journalists, you make the observation that some journalists step out of the media and into Parliament.
Yeah, and vice versa.
To be advisors.
And it's just this system, this is agreement of how things work with like drops and things that like you'll go to one organisation like, I'm going to give you this exclusive. And these journalists know, and a lot of them are kind of more junior, like know that if they toe the line and they ride it the way that the government or the opposition wants it, then they're going to get another drop and they'll get a front page story. And there's this pressure internally within these news organisations to have exclusives and get front pages and stuff. And so it just makes it this very cycle where scrutiny can get diluted because of the way that it works and the proximity in which they're all working together and they're having beers after work and they are changing jobs and they're going from one newsroom to another and then into advising an MP on their media policy.
So that's the reality, and a lot of that feels quite opaque. You know, we feel quite powerless in the face of all that, in the face of all those systems, in the face of the status quo. How do we cut through as a community, as individuals? And also you talk about finding a kind of radical core of empathy as a driver. How do we cut through?
I think that there's diminishing returns on spending time in the halls of Parliament, like looking for answers there and looking for solutions there.
So you're not going to run for Parliament anytime soon?
No. And I get asked that a lot, and I think this comes back to this idea that I think we're all kind of waiting for someone to come and inspire everyone and do these rallying talks and like and everyone's like rallying, like, yeah, we're going to save the planet and we're going to save Australia. But like that's not going to happen. Like no one is coming. Like and anyone who is incredible and talented and then can tick all the boxes will have something in their camera roll that will undo them, or there'll be some reason why. And that, I'm not talking about myself.
Oh, sure.
there'll be some like the system is so pitted against anyone coming along and just radically changing the way that our democracy and our parliamentary system works. Like, it's just not going to happen.
Okay, so how will rebellious hope change the world?
We have to take responsibility for ourselves and each other, and we have to build these systems of care with each other, with the natural world, and start to understand that we are in a period of collapse. Collapse has begun. It's not coming. They said we had 10 years to stop the worst of climate change and tipping points happening by 2030. 2030 is pretty soon, and we've already kind of outpaced what we thought was going to happen, right? So because we barely ever talk about climate change. It's barely in the media, but the climate is changing nonetheless. Mm. And so we have to start preparing for the new world, and that might not sound hopeful. And maybe you want me to say everything's going to be okay and we're going to solve climate change. We might. We might solve climate change, but not in the ways that our economies and our governments are set up. They are not designed to fix existential problems that they created. They have no vested interest in doing that. But we have vested interest in doing that because we don't want to die. But we have so much to live for, and we still have so much of our natural world to save
and
to cherish.
But it's not just about us. It's about future generations.
And future generations.
And all the other species on this earth.
Yeah. And so it gives me hope that we have no choice. We've painted ourselves. We've got red paint on our feet or whatever, colour what you want. And we'll do it. But it just means we have to get back to basics. And that's why I feel so silly sometimes. I'm like, we just got to care for each other.
So what does that look like to you, getting back to basics?
I think, yeah, like you said, empathy before. And I think that is something that I think that we need to spend so much more time teaching each other how to have empathy, how to hold these ideas. Oh, like this is a big conversation. Like, let's like let's have this conversation together and let's figure out what the next step is. We can picture something in 2050, which is where I set the book, but we can also picture what we're going to do today and for the next week. And we just need to get better at like being able to look each other in the eye and hold each other's anxieties and problems and differences in a way that is founded in empathy and understanding that we all kind of carry different things into this room. We all have different ideas of what the world could be, but we know, I think, at least in this room, that we want better things and we have to work together to make them happen.
We can make beautiful things happen together. Yeah. Let's take a couple of questions. We've got a couple of minutes and we've got a roving mic, which Renee, who's one of the movers and shakers who make this festival happen. Thank you, Renee. We've got a question there and a question there and a question there.
Thanks, Jack. That was absolutely fascinating. I'm on my way to buy the book straight after this. I was really interested in your comment about the way that we revere these billionaires and an interesting comment that we sort of think there's somehow that we can get there. And I'm just thinking, you know, history may judge these billionaires like we judge the slave owners. And, you know, we'll be having people's names taken down from things. But at the time, those slave owners were in power and revered. You know, so that was an observation. My question to you is how do we really show them for who they are? The Amazon workers are basically like slaves of the 18th century. So how do we sort of change the thinking and stop, you know, reduce the reverence and hold them more accountable or see them for who they are, which is people who are exploiting other people.
Thank you. And it reminds me of Tim Winton's book, if you've read Juice, read Tim Winton's book, Juice.
Well, it's hard to do that because they own all the media. But they also don't have any buildings or in their name. Like, where's the Elon Musk Centre of Excellence for Medical Technologies? Doesn't exist. So we don't have to worry about taking their names off things because they're not investing in good things anyway. So that's one problem that we don't have to contend with. The other problem is, like, yeah, it's very hard to explain the scale of wealth. I think that people are starting to feel it in their own lives because then these kind of false stories that we are told in society around just pull your socks up and work hard and you'll get there, it's just not true. And the more that happens, the more that people come to this realization that, like, yeah, that's kind of all bullshit, and it's because, in a lot of ways, it's because of these people are the ones that are selling this lie. And also the fact that the Amazon workers are going to be robots. It will happen. I always think it's funny that they're making all their bunkers and stuff, like all the billionaires have their bunkers and they think that, like, their security guards are going to look after them after everything turns to shit. Like, I mean, I guess that's why they're all doing, like they're all getting kind of roided out now because they're trying to, you know, be strong as well. But, foregone conclusion is it's going to happen. I don't know if there's a way to do it because I think they're going to do it to themselves.
Hi. Just small steps and current and thinking about the housing crisis. The government's made some small but significant changes or muted them to negative gearing and capital gains, which are now being attacked from the business sector and the other side of parliament. And there's a lot of fake news about that. I mean, negative gearing is quarantined, the capital gains tax, businesses are still going to be able to write off their losses against future earnings. How do we and who do we talk to get the government to hold their stead here? Because releasing some of that housing to the rental market makes, you know, it's going to help people get into private housing and it's going to enable more people to get into community housing through more rental stock.
Yeah. Well, as I mentioned earlier, the idea of capital gains tax discount was meant to encourage people to invest their money in the stock market. So removing the capital gains tax discount or reducing it for both housing and investment doesn't do that. It just punishes both cohorts, and then grandfathering it doesn't make people sell their property and then become rental. So there's like a millennial entrepreneurial argument that is kind of what's come out of this, is the idea that, well, we haven't been able to afford housing and so we put our money in the stock market. And where some of the few people that are actually investing in the future, maybe, and that you could make that argument, then removing both doesn't actually help us because it's grandfathered, so it's not actually going to reduce. We need to make it unattractive to own housing as an asset. Hmm. And we're not doing that by grandfathering it, I guess, is the point, right?
Turn it back into a home rather than an investment strategy.
So we should make it really annoying. So I come back to this idea of renters' rights. I have made this joke, this is the third time I've made this joke, but if the government had read my book and they saw the CGT things and they were inspired by it, they forgot to read any pages before and after that, which also spoke about building public housing and also having renters' rights where we're allowed to like treat that. If we were paying rent there, we should treat it as our home and we should be able to do what we, like in the same way you buy, you rent commercial real estate, you can do anything to the internal structure of that building. And it often increases the value of the owner's building anyway because you're not going to make it worse. I would like to be able to retail my rental bathroom. It will make the value of the property better, but I can't do it because I don't own the property and that's not the way. But anyway, I digress. We have to have a suite of things. We have to make housing unattractive as a investment, and we've only done that now for people that are trying to get... It's only now unattractive for the people that were just about to get into the housing market. So we've stopped a new generation of landlords. That's cool, but that doesn't benefit me for 20 years.
Yeah.
And so we need to have other things that get people out of the market. So I think the government probably should have wargamed this a little bit more. Maybe they should have read more of my book than just the one page.
Yeah.
And I think they wouldn't be having to contend with this like misinformation campaign and stuff because they would have just done something that was almost immediately beneficial to a large, like a huge portion of the population, which is 30% of renters, if they just did something about increasing our lot in life.
So just to wrap, it's also about storytelling, isn't it? And you are a storyteller. You have an incredibly successful social media presence. How important is the stories? Are the stories that we tell?
Again, it's just like there's 65,000 years of storytelling in here, and that teaches generations after generation after generation about how to live and how to live and care for each other. And storytelling is ultimately everything. And I think that we've lost the art in a lot of ways in a lot of societies. We have like really succinct messages. We have slogans. We don't have stories. We don't uphold stories in the same way that previous generations did. And this continent has a rich history. And so I think that, that's we need storytellers. I think that we need to be better at telling each other stories and telling the truth to each other.
Radical acceptance, rebellious hope, and telling great stories. It's an epic effort that you undertook. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for being here. Have a great day at the festival, and please thank Jack Toohey.
Thank you. Thank you.
Jack Toohey's book is called Better Things Are Possible: How Rebellious Hope Will Change the World. And you can catch his videos on social media. Jack joined me at the Make Good Festival at Bundanon in New South Wales, a really eclectic, inspired festival exploring all sorts of ideas for a better world. Now, if you'd like to join me to be in the audience of upcoming events I'm hosting, there are absolutely oodles on the horizon. You can head to the Big Ideas homepage, scroll on down, look for Be In Our Audience to find out what's coming up. But it includes in Brisbane on the 24th of July, I'm hosting a panel interrogating the controversies and challenges faced by literary circles and the creative arts right now around intellectual freedom, freedom of expression, and what that means for democracy and more. In August, I'm hosting three fabulous sessions at the Byron Writers Festival and what will be a feisty three sessions at the huge Festival of Dangerous Ideas on in Sydney. And don't miss the Beaker Street Festival in Hobart during National Science Week for our annual great debate. The topic this year, by the way, is a cracker. Should the social media ban be extended to over 16s. It's going to be a raucous night of fun and argument and ideas and live music. So get along to that if you're in Hobart. Coming up next on Big Ideas, speaking of speaking up and out for a better world, join journalist and former editor of Guardian Australia, Lenore Taylor, for a vital discussion on whistleblowing with leading advocates, but it will also feature an anonymised voice of one very courageous whistleblower, and here is part of their testimony.
I was working in a children's prison when I witnessed several events which made me extremely concerned for the welfare of young people. In this prison, young people faced extended periods of isolation. There were not enough staff to be able to facilitate the children leaving their rooms. They were kept like animals in spaces the size of a car park for 23 and a half hours a day. This quickly became a normalized part of working in the prison. Then one day, a young person managed to set light to his mattress while he was locked in his room. The fire alarms went off and everyone had to evacuate. But it was determined by more senior ranking staff that there were not enough staff members to safely remove the boy from his room. The rigid internal hierarchies meant that the humane decision to remove the boy could not be made by the staff member. It's lucky he didn't die. But these things don't need to be left to luck. Our obsession with protecting ourselves meant that the imminent danger to the young person was less important than the possible risk to the staff member. We have a colossal issue with Indigenous deaths in custody in this country. These issues are caught up in dehumanising hierarchies and rigid pathways of authority. That staff member was technically a guardian to that boy. He had a responsibility to protect him. I first realised things were not right when my male colleague broke down and cried in the office. It is not usual in this country for a grown man to cry at work, especially not a man who works in a prison. On this day, my colleague had witnessed children on the cameras pacing back and forth, bashing on the doors, screaming, desperate. Things were very tense. When we were able to have contact with the young people, they spoke from a place of experiencing intense terror. Some became suicidal. We consoled ourselves with phrases like, "You have to be tough to work in here," and "That's just how things are." It was continuously confusing and hurtful to us that leadership failed to listen when we approached them as calm and concerned humans witnessing inhumane activities. It is challenging to say that you believe something is wrong when people around you condone and even endorse the behaviour. I knew we had to do something, and we started by using the organisation's internal channels with no positive result. After having exhausted internal channels, a group of employees collectively wrote an account of the wrongdoing we had witnessed and sought legal advice. In our case, we were protected because we acted as a group. Being part of a group gave us courage, and it protected our sanity and our humanity. The legal advice we received made us aware that, despite the protections that come with raising concerns through Parliament, there were grave practical risks to us and our employment. For some of us, the risk extended to visa statuses and the capacity to continue to live and work in this country. The threat of these reprisals was enough to silence us. The members of our group have families, they have dependents, they have mortgages. The power of the government to destroy livelihoods, to resort to unjust sanctions because they can and we cannot, well, that's violence right there. Those are the bars of our cage, as cold and hard as any steel.
More on Big Ideas next, The Whistleblowers. You can find the Big Ideas podcast on ABC Listen or however you hear them. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Email us, bigideas@abc.net.au. The Radio National text line, 0418 226 576. 0418 226 576. Send us your messages. Thanks for joining me today.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.